The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
And now, The Trumpet Daily with Stephen Flurry.
Hello again, everyone, and welcome back to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. We are back live in the studio here at Edstone, returning yesterday afternoon. Some pretty big snowdrifts left over from the big storm last week. Most of it, though, melted off by the time we rolled into Edstone. So like I mentioned on the program yesterday, it was as if we just barely escaped the big storm right here at Edstone before we headed up into the mountains, where we just had a nice thin layer of snow covering the region like a sheet. It made it beautiful, the hikes that we were able to take up in the Lake District. But it's beautiful back here at Edstone. I was telling my wife on the way home just about some of the hikes and the walks that we were able to enjoy. There's plenty of walk, not as many mountains, smaller mountains for England, I guess, in and around Edstone, but there certainly are plenty of hiking paths and walking paths to take advantage of. So just a beautiful area where God has placed his name here in the Midlands. Well, I have to start today's program by making somewhat of a confession. Last week, just before we took off for the campout, I gave a forum to the students, the college students, the academy students, and so many of them, of course, make their way off to the Robbers Cave camp out there in Oklahoma, and we had ours here in England. I encourage them to get away from the gadgets and to take a book and to maybe even start a mini reading club to get in some extra reading during the camp out and to discuss some of those things that you're reading, that you're studying. And we did do that at the campfire just the other night up there on, I guess it was Sunday night at our camp out. But at the same time, we watched two movies, not one movie night. We actually watched a second one the night before we left as well. The first one we saw was a movie from 1986. It seems like it wasn't that long ago, but I remember seeing this movie when I was a teenager. It's called Hoosiers, the Indiana basketball story. I think the show or the program is based loosely on a true story, but a really uplifting message coming out of that 1986 movie. And then the other one, my absolute all-time favorite sports movie, is a movie called Miracle from 2004. And I think in that case, the director got it pretty much spot on. And many of the actual players from the 1980 USA Olympic hockey team even attested to that the actor playing Herb Brooks, Coach Herb Brooks, was pretty much just like Herb Brooks was back in 1980. You can actually get to that actual game from 1980 on YouTube. This is maybe one of the positives of something like YouTube. There's quite an archive there, and you could go back, as I did last night with the family, and fast forward through some of the highlights of the actual game. I actually can remember watching it when I was 10 years old. And of course, at the time, just as the movie brings out, I mean, this hockey team that no one knew about two or three weeks before the Olympics, it just took the nation by storm. And it came at a time, of course, coming off of the 1970s and into the Iran hostage crisis. What an uplift that Miracle on Ice was. You can go to the end of the YouTube clip, by the way, and see what's probably the most memorable sports call in U.S. history. Here's a snippet from the 1980 Olympics hockey game. This is clip 7.
The crowd going insane. Carloman shooting it into the American end again. Morrow is back there. Now Johnson, 19 seconds. Johnson over to Ramsey. Do you let it off? Gets checked by Ramsey. McClanahan is there. The puck is still loose. 11 seconds. You've got 10 seconds. The countdown going on right now. Morrow up to Schultz. 5 seconds left in the game. Do you believe in miracles? Yes!
Unbelievable.
That's from the 1980 Olympic semifinal game. That was the U.S. against Russia. And the U.S. won the game 4-3. As I say, one of the more memorable sports calls in history. They went on to win the final game 2 days later against, I think it was Finland. In any event, as I say, that this movie got it pretty much spot on. If you haven't seen it, I think it's well worth seeing. It's by today's standards, it's fairly clean. Really, not really much profanity in it. At all. And so both of these movies, though, I think there's a few things that we'll go through here today that it just struck me as I watched these movies again. I hadn't seen them in a number of years. I saw them many, many years ago. But it just struck me about how much things have changed, certainly in the world of entertainment. But even some of the themes that were stressed and highlighted in these two movies, in both cases, with Hoosiers and Miracle, you had an authoritarian figure at the top, a coach in both cases, a man of character for the most part. They had their flaws, Herb Brooks and I forget the other coach's name, Norman Dale, I think his name was, in the Hoosiers movie. But both of them came into their respective jobs or responsibilities. And, I mean, they really had an idea of what had to play out. It had to be a certain way. There was an authoritarian figure. There was government from the top down. And this is unusual. You don't see this portrayed in so many movies and television programs today. Anytime you see or hear or read about government, I mean, government's always a bad thing. It's always something you want to get out of the way. And of course, there's plenty of abuses in a form of government that works from the top down. But when it's righteous, this is brought out in our literature. I'll get to that in just a second. But when it's a man of character at the top, look at the good that it can produce. You see that in both of these films. This first clip here I'll play for you is from Hoosiers. This is where the coach has, well, he's just trying to establish rules. This is how we're going to play the game. We're going to make this many passes. And if you don't make this many passes before you shoot, then you're not going to play. Well, if you know anything about the movie, they didn't have too many players to work with. I think they had six at a time or seven at the most. But in this particular scene, the coach pulls this kid off the floor because he was shooting too much. And he sits him down, and then, as you'll hear, they put in the replacement, and then somebody fouls out, and they're left with just four people on the court. And then one player who hadn't fouled out, but the coach sat him down because he wasn't submitting to the program. Here's a clip from Hoosiers, clip one.
Where are you going?
In the game.
Sit down.
What do you mean? You gotta have five out there.
Sit down. Sit.
Coach, need one more.
My team's on the floor.
What are you trying to do?
So the coach there benches this player to make a point. The team goes on and finishes the game with just four players, four against five. They lose the game. But he went through all of this just to establish his authority. What I say goes, the coach is bringing out. The adult, the man, the leader. It was soon after that scene then that he has this this exchange with his team in the locker room, basically laying down the law. Here's clip two.
Those of you on the floor at the end, I'm proud of you. Played your guts out. I'm only going to say this one time. All of you have the weekend. Think about whether or not you want to be on this team or not. Under the following condition. What I say when it comes to this basketball team is the law, absolutely and without discussion.
That's Coach Dale saying what I say is the law, absolutely and without discussion. How's that kind of a message going to fly today in the United States or anywhere in the West? On college campuses? In households? I mean, it worked for that team from back in the 1950s. I think the story came out of Indiana in 1954. I mean, something worked there. This is a team that, this underdog team that won a state championship. The Indiana State Basketball Championship. With a man in charge who benched a player and wouldn't put him back on. Even after another guy fouled out. And he says to the team, what I say goes. What I say with respect to this basketball team. It is the law, absolutely and without discussion. If you look at some of the things that my father's written in our literature, either about the way that God's government is used today or the way that it was during the days of Herbert Armstrong, and also you look at the fatal flaw of so many Laodicean brethren, so many lukewarm brethren. He writes about this in the Key of David vision. When God establishes a work, he always begins it with one man. God has consistently established that his government pattern features one man at the top. As the work grows, other men are called to support that man and so on. He says, Herbert Armstrong learned and taught that God's work can only be successfully completed by using God's government. Mr. Armstrong, especially in his latter years, always stressed the vital importance of learning and properly using God's government. And then he goes on and talks about how so many of God's people today talk about the evils of one-man government. The evils of this kind of authority. They see it as evil. They see it as something we need to do away with. It's not just our society. It's not just in the university. It's not just in government even today. Even in God's church. Now, my father brings out how that, of course, men are evil and men at the top of many organizations do evil things. He writes, certainly men can mishandle God's pattern of government, but where is the problem? Where's the problem when that happens? Is it the pattern of government or men? Is it the form of God's government that's the problem, or is the problem with man? He says, we must recognize that men are evil, not the government pattern. The way that God has organized the family or the government and the church, that's not the problem. The problem is evil men. The problem is human nature. The problem is Satan the devil and his influence. My father says here, the position of head in God's government is compared to that of a father. The head of the church and work must love those under him as a father would naturally love his children. All those under God's government must love and respect the head as children would love and respect their father. So here you have, just to use again, these two these two examples from the entertainment world, a world that was very different just a generation or two ago than it is today. But you had an authoritarian father figure, a loving father figure at the head, who loved the team, who corrected the team, who motivated the team, who brought the team together, or the family, as one of the ice hockey players said, in Miracle. And that brings me to another lesson that you can take away from these two films. Quite unlike the kinds of films like in the Academy Awards the other night, the ones that are showcased today, just the bizarre, anything that's bizarre and perverse, that's what's up on display. I mean, when did it come that all these movies that are up for awards are movies you never even have heard of? Just horrible films in so many cases. Well, it wasn't that long ago when you could actually leave a theater feeling uplifted, maybe even inspired. There might be a rare exception today, but they are rare. In these two movies, what stood out to me just in watching them again over the weekend is the concept that the team is far more important than the individual members or the individual parts. You have to be a winning team. You have to play together. You have to be unified. There's a scene in Miracle. This is a little bit of a longer clip, but I'm playing it because it's probably the best scene of the movie, in my view anyway. It's the goosebump scene, as my wife often says. But they play, it was somewhere in Scandinavia. They were playing an exhibition just to get ready for the Olympics, and it came out to a draw. They tied this other team, and the coach saw the players on the bench distracted, looking at ladies in the crowd and such like that. And so he grabbed the whistle, even as people were filing out of the stadium, and told his players to get out on the ice and said, if you don't want to work during the game, then we'll work you right now. We'll work you after the game. And so here's the memorable scene from Miracle where he keeps saying over and again, get on that line. We're going to run lines again and again. Here's that scene, clip 4.
You keep playing this way, you won't beat anybody who's even good, let alone great. You want to make this team, and you better start playing at a level that's going to force me to keep you here. Again.
Okay, we're getting out of here.
Hey, where are you going? Back on the line. Again. Send them. Silky, you gonna be the first one to quit on me? How about you, OC? You ready to go down? I think I got my money on you, Verkota. Of course, you got a hot date in about an hour, but you're not looking too good for that right about now, are you? Send them. Again.
Okay. Doc, I mean, this is madness, right?
This cannot be a team of common men, because common men go nowhere. You have to be uncommon. Again.
Herb, this has gone on long enough.
Everybody on that line.
Somebody's going to get hurt.
Everybody get on that line. Hey. Again. Again.
Herb.
Come on, Craig, blow the whistle. Again.
Michael Ruzioni! Went through Massachusetts!
Who do you play for?
I play for the United States of America!
That's all, gentlemen.
That's old school coaching. But did it get results? He had been leading up to that. He had been asking each of the players, you know, what's your name? Where you come from? Who do you play for? And of course, they came from all of these hockey schools that hated each other. University of Rhode Island or Wisconsin or Minnesota. And they kept saying, well, I play for the University of Rhode Island or Maine. And then finally, you heard Ruzioni there say, I play for the United States of America. There's another scene in the movie where the coach says, the name on the front of the jersey, it's a lot more important than the name on the back. The team is more important than the individual members. If you look at what we understand about God's team, what the Bible says in 1 Corinthians 12 or Ephesians 4 about God placing the members where it pleases him. Herbert Armstrong has quite a long section in Mystery of the Ages about God setting us as individual members into this spiritual organism. It says here, this is from Mystery. The author, Christ's apostle, can say emphatically that the apostles, evangelists, pastors, and elders could not carry on the work of God without the loyal backing and continual encouragement of the lay members. Neither can the individual lay member develop and build within him God's holy, righteous, and perfect character without the operations of the apostle, evangelists, pastors, and elders. All these various members God has set in his church are interdependent, mutually dependent on one another. They form a team, an organized spiritual organism, utterly different from any secular and worldly organization. It's the team in the end that wins. Even sports today, very different than what it once was. You go back, and I'm not much of a hockey fan, but you go back and watch some of that game from 1980. Nobody thought the United States had a chance. They were playing against seasoned professionals from Russia or the Soviet Union. A team, in the case of the Soviets, that had been playing together for years and years and years. But Coach Brooks brought these young boys together, these 20-somethings together, fresh out of college. And he established law and order. And he emphasized the team. The only way that we're going to beat this team, the Russians, is if we play as a team. And that's what he set out to build. He only had 7 months to do it. But in watching that 1980 game, I suppose the game has probably changed a lot since then. It's been almost 40 years after all. But you had the Russians controlling the puck for a lot of the game, but you had the United States just swarming from beginning to end. They were in shape. The individual parts all working together. It paid off. It paid off. How many of them? How many of them do you suppose, assuming that that scene, the again scene, actually happened? How many of them, after they were receiving their gold medal there, thought, you know what, I'd rather go back and not go the way that I did. I wish it would have been easier, because we still could have won. They knew. They knew. They had to put in that time, that effort. Mr. Armstrong, going back to Mystery of the Ages, he says, what about the private or individual Christian who says, I don't want to be part of the church? I want to seek my salvation direct and alone with Christ. The answer is this. God himself laid out the plan and the method by which humans may be, after begettal, trained and prepared to become part of the divine personnel of born God beings that shall form the kingdom of God. I mean, God's laid out the plan. What he says is the law. This is the way. There is no other way. Mr. Armstrong says, the person who says, I'll get my salvation alone outside the church is totally deceived. If we think we can do this alone or as an individual star, instead of as part of the body, we are totally deceived. Now, each member does play an important role. Again, 1 Corinthians 12 and Ephesians 4 bring this out. But it's the body as a whole. It's the organism, the spiritual organism as a whole. That's the body God's working through. Ephesians 4:16 says, from whom the whole body fitly joined together, or framed together, as RSV says, and compacted by that which every joint supplies, according to the effectual working in the measure of every part, makes increase of the body unto the edifying of itself in love. I mean, if every part is working, then the body increases its effectiveness. Then the body can do more for Christ. Some valuable lessons there. Straight out of Mystery of the Ages. He says here, Mr. Armstrong does, the church is organized on God's pattern of mutual teamwork and cooperation to function perfectly together. They shall become the God family. He says further on, take an analogy from Satan's world. A football player says, I want to play in all of the games, but I'll train alone. I don't want to be part of the team until the games start. Would the coach let him be part of the team in the games without having learned teamwork during practice season? He says, neither will God let one into his family at the resurrection who refused to be part of it now in the church, in the spiritual training season. There's lots and lots of Laodiceans out there that have gone it alone, that think they can work their way into God's kingdom on their own plan, according to their own ideas. These people are totally deceived. Totally deceived. That's in chapter 6, by the way, of Mystery of the Ages. The team, much more important than the individual parts. When we come back, we'll see if we can pull together a few more. I'm already looking at the clock thinking I've got too much material here. But we'll pull together a couple more lessons, I think, that stood out from these older movies, these classics from from a number of years ago. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. We'll be right back.
This is KPCG-FM, and this is the Trumpet Daily.
To America's founding fathers, character meant everything to the success of the nation and its leadership. The Constitution was based upon the fundamental principles of religion and morality. These were the primary building blocks of the American nation. George Washington said, "The foundations of our national policy will be laid in the pure and immutable principles of private morality." Character was no minor issue to America's first president. He regarded it as the basis of national policy. Where did the founding fathers develop these ideas? Many of these principles stemmed from the Holy Scriptures. The Bible provided early Americans with the instruction and guidance of how to properly govern one's life. These beliefs helped build a nation of strong families and upright leaders. Today, America has dismissed the Bible as the foundation of developing righteous character. Men now leave it to themselves to determine right from wrong. Where has the rejection of biblically based principles led this nation? There is a cause for these effects. To understand the course of events that have led this nation to its current state, visit thetrumpet.com and click on the literature tab to request our free booklet, Character in Crisis.
The Trumpet Daily Radio Show airs every morning at 7 a.m. Central Time on KPCG 101.3 FM in Edmond, Oklahoma.
Snyder, buzz, long slap shot, saved by Mushkin.
The U.S. team is depending a little bit too much now on Jim Craig. He's making too many good saves.
Arruzioni! Mike Arruzioni!
That's from the 1980 hockey game between the USA and the Soviet Union in Lake Placid, New York. That was the winning goal, Mike Arruzioni. And again, going back to the movie made about the story in 2004, like it happened in real time, it was scored, I think, with like 10 minutes to go. And rather than to dramatize it more by putting the goal right at the very end, the movie shows the goal being scored at 10 minutes to go, and then the suspense of trying to keep the Russians from scoring, which if you've seen the actual hockey game, I mean, you're just on the edge of your seat, if not standing, hoping that the United States could hold on. One theme from both of these movies, I think particularly from Hoosiers, another one that you don't see much today in literature or in modern movies, current movies. And that's that if you make a big mistake, and we've all made them, everyone deserves a second chance if you're willing to respond to correction and if you're genuinely repentant. I mean, I'm maybe putting a little more of a spiritual emphasis on these points. I mean, there was no discussion of repentance in either of these movies. Not the way that the Bible talks about it, of course. But in both cases, with respect to Hoosiers, I mean, here was a flawed coach working with flawed players. But given a second chance, they made corrections. They made changes. The coach had to change, and of course, if you know anything about Hoosiers, he offers an assistant position to one of the players' fathers, who happens to be a drunk. And here's how that offer went down. This is the coach basically offering this father an assistant position if he makes some changes. Clip three.
I got a proposition for you. Mm-hmm. Cleo's going to be laid up for a while. And why don't you give me a hand?
Well, I can tell you anything that you need to know.
No, you don't understand. I want you to be my assistant. I want you to come to practices and sit on the bench with me during the games.
Me? You want me?
What do you say? Under the following conditions. That you clean yourself up. And
you shave and
you show up at the games on time and the practices, and you wear a shirt and tie.
Well, I got myself a suit right there. I got a wingdinger. I was married in that suit there.
And that you're sober.
I know. My wife sent you.
No.
My son. What has my drinking got to do with my knowledge about basketball?
You can't drink in front of these boys. If I smell even a trace of liquor on your breath, you'd be finished.
I have to hear that from you.
You're embarrassing your son.
That's from the movie Hoosiers. The coach there offering a position to this father, so long as he got cleaned up, and he did, at least for a time. He relapsed toward the end. But he had to, if he wanted to take hold of this opportunity, he had to make changes. He had to do some things differently. And in the other movie, I mean, you had this coach, this unique, unorthodox coach who was going up against a system, this Olympic committee that just wanted to do the same thing every 4 years. And every 4 years, the USA kept getting beat. And here comes Herb Brooks saying, look, we've got to do things differently. Even the NHL All-Stars were playing the Russians and losing because they weren't playing as a team. So they had to make changes. We have to change if we have a chance to win. Now, going back to the correction angle, if you look at what God says in Hebrews 12, it says, for whom the Lord loves, he chastens. He scourges every son whom he receives. God's dealing with us as sons. And if we don't accept correction, well, you can read the next couple of verses. It says that spiritually we're bastards. We'll be out there on our own without a father, without a loving authority in our lives, without a loving father to guide our steps, as Jeremiah 10 says. My father wrote, this is way back in 1993, a personal on God's family government. He says, our greatest curse is when our father no longer corrects us. Then we're no longer part of his family. God ceases to be our father. Well, just in this passage, Hebrews 12, verse 9 says, furthermore, we've had fathers of our flesh which corrected us, and we gave them reverence. Shall we not much rather be in subjection unto the Father of spirits and live? For they verily for a few days chastened us after their own pleasure, or just according to their own understanding. But he, God, for our profit, that we might be partakers of his holiness. It says in Hebrews 12:11 here, verse 11, now no chastening for the present seems to be joyous, but grievous. Nevertheless, afterward, it yields the peaceable fruit of righteousness unto them which are exercised thereby. I mean, the correction that U.S. hockey team received in Scandinavia after the game, where they had to run lines again and again and again. It certainly at the time didn't seem to be joyous. It was grievous. But what did it produce? What will godly correction produce if we receive it, if we accept it, if we respond to it, if we change, if we repent? God hasn't, he hasn't established all these laws to deprive us of anything or to burden us. Those laws, the laws of God, are there in place for our own good. What he says goes. And if we stay within those parameters, we will be blessed. There will be peaceable fruit. Fruits of righteousness that are produced. That's what we have to remember. Where would we be? Where could we be if we didn't accept correction? Correction from a loving father. Another theme that really emerges from both of these stories is that hard work, diligent work, is a whole lot more important than talent alone. There's something to be said for talent. But hard work is more important. It certainly is in God's eyes. Here's another clip from, let's see, which one is this from? This is from the movie Miracle, clip number 5.
Back, far, red line, back. And you have 45 seconds to do it. Get used to this drill. We'll be doing it a lot. Why?
Because the legs feed the wolf, gentlemen.
I can't promise you we'll be the best team at Lake Placid next February.
But we will be the best conditioned team. That I can promise you.
Be prepared to grow through pain, gentlemen. You're going to skate harder than you've ever skated in your lives. Every minute of every day you're on the ice with me.
Grow through pain. That's not a message that is going to win over the snowflakes these days. Be prepared for it, though. Be prepared for the pain. I can't promise that we're going to be the best team at Lake Placid, but we will be the best conditioned team. That I can promise you. We will work the hardest. That I can tell you. We will outwork the opposition. We've talked before about the 10,000 hours rule. I forget who wrote about that. Maybe it was Malcolm Gladwell. But how that all of the so-called experts, they weren't just born in positions of prominence. They really worked at it. They put in the hours, hundreds and hundreds, thousands of hours, developing in their specialized field. Dr. Elat Mazar, as I think I mentioned last week, we conducted some interviews with people who know her well. We, of course, interviewed her as well. But in one of the interviews from a couple of weeks ago, her sister, Tally, she talked about just the way Elat approached her studies and her love for archaeology when she was a teenager. Of course, she worked alongside her grandfather, Benjamin Mazar. She really admired his work in archaeology. She tried to go to as many of his classes, his college classes, even before she was in college. She was still a teenager. Then she went off to the army, as all Israeli young people do, for her 1 or 2 year stint, I forget which. And then she comes back, gets into the university, and continues right on with her study, her lifelong study, as it happens to be. Tally, her sister, says, and then she never stopped. I think she loved study. when she had the little children. She waited until after they went to sleep to study. She loves it, Tally says. She loves it. This is her life. It's why she wrote so many books. She loves what she's doing. And Tally says, this is a blessing. It's a blessing to be able to put in the time, to be able to really work at something diligently, to work hard at it. As I say, you look at both of those movies, and you had to work hard, and the ones that didn't were cut, or they were kicked off the team in the case of Hoosiers. If you weren't willing to put in the time to work hard at something, in this case basketball or hockey, then you didn't deserve to be on the team. Well, going back to what Herbert Armstrong said in Mystery of the Ages, what about the spiritual team? And what must God think if we're there, supposedly as a member, but we're not willing to put in the time to really work at this way of life, to really work at supporting God's work and church? What a standard God sets. Become you therefore perfect, even as your Father, which is in heaven, is perfect. I see now, it is Malcolm Gladwell, he says in his book about this 10,000-hour rule. He said, people at the very top, they don't work just harder or even much harder than everyone else. They work much, much harder. That's how they get to the top. That's how the Miracle on Ice happened. I mean, we call it a miracle, and I don't know how to what extent God would have been or may have been involved, but they worked. They outworked their opponents. And it's an inspiring story of what it takes to be a champion. There's definite laws in place when you look at this again spiritually. And if we stay within those boundaries and then really go to work, becoming more and more perfect, or striving for perfection, Matthew 5:48, then look at what God is offering us. Another theme that really kind of dovetails perfectly with this one, the one I just mentioned there, is that to become a champion, you have to be willing to make some painful sacrifices. You have to. Nothing's going to come easy. Nothing's going to come easy. You have to sacrifice. And when you look at what the Bible says about, I talked about this on yesterday's show, you have to be willing as a good soldier to not be entangled by the affairs of this life. You have to be willing, as Paul said in 1 Corinthians 9, to exercise self-control. I mean, Paul even used the sports analogy multiple times, but certainly there in 1 Corinthians 9. He said, every athlete exercises self-control in all things. They do it to receive a perishable wreath, but we an imperishable. Well, I do not run aimlessly, Paul said. I do not box as one beating the air, but I pummel my body and subdue it, lest after preaching to others, I myself should be disqualified. It's inspiring, really, when you see an athlete or a team in these two examples I've given you here today that's really disciplined. You're not going to get that far on talent alone. You have to be able to put in the work as well. One final theme that I want to touch on here before we conclude. This is brought out specifically in the Miracle movie. And that is that you can't beat the Soviets by playing defense. You have to attack. This fits right along with what I discussed on the program yesterday. You have to go on the offensive. Here's another clip from the movie Miracle, clip 8.
And everyone in this room knows what people are saying about our chances. I know it. You know it. But I also know there is a way to stay with this team. You don't defend them. You attack them. You take their game and you shove it right back in their face. The team that is finally willing to do this is the team that has a chance to put them down. NHL won't change their game. We will. The rest of the world is afraid of them. Boys, we won't be. No one has ever worked hard enough to skate with the Soviet team for an entire game. Gentlemen, we are going to work hard enough.
Another great scene from the movie Miracle, based upon the 1980 hockey game between the USA and the Soviet Union from the Olympics there at Lake Placid. You're not going to beat this powerhouse by playing defense. You have to attack them. You can't be afraid of this team that's won every Olympics since 1960. A 20-year run. You're not going to take them down by backpedaling. You've got to take your game to them. You've got to attack them. You've got to go on the offensive. And they did. Like I said, you watch some of that actual game from 1980, and it's as if the U.S. team is just like a swarm of bees all over the place, taking it to the Russians. We have a team here in the U.K., Manchester City, in the Premier League, that's just dominating the league, just running away with it. And there was a headline at ESPN yesterday, ESPN.co.uk, I think it was, that talked about Manchester City, and this commentator who said that the only way you're going to beat them is if you attack them. There's a lesson in this, as I covered yesterday on the program from this ESPN article. It says Chelsea's unambitious, I guess Man City played Chelsea recently and Chelsea lost. And so it's saying here, Chelsea's unambitious and timid approach to this game was nothing new this season. City have come up against many other teams who have tried and failed to smother Guardiola's team, that's the coach, I guess, with ultra-defensive tactics. So many other teams, you see, they've really shored up the defense. Man City's got all these spectacular scores, and so we've really got to buckle down on defense. It says later, too many teams have been cowed by City this season, beaten before they even leave the tunnel, before the game. And it's impossible to fathom why so many have tried to sit back and defend. Every single team is trying the exact same thing. None of them will change. The only teams, it says, to have any kind of success against City this season have been those who have been prepared to fight fire with fire. It says Liverpool is the only club to beat City in the Premier League this term, and they did so by attacking Guardiola's men from all angles. They did it by attacking from all angles. And they pull off the stunning upset. Imagine that. Like I said on yesterday's show, when you think about our adversary, our opponent, what we're going up against, we can't, like my father brings out in the Overcomer booklet, we can't get out on the battlefield and hesitate. We can't backpedal. We can't go out onto the field and know that, well, this is impossible. It's an impossible task. like we've lost before the game even started. You're not going to beat the Russians by playing defense. You have to attack. You have to go on the offensive. Well, there's some other thoughts here that I had just with respect to entertainment in general and how different and depressing and perverse so much of it is today, even compared to a generation or two ago. But I'll have to save that for another time. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. If you'd like to email the program and tell me about your favorite sports movie, you can send that to td@kpcg.fm. Thank you for joining us today, and we'll see you tomorrow.